Do you know how much cash back you're leaving on the table for settling for the wrong credit card? Imagine earning up to 5% cash back on your groceries for the next 30 years. Just think of all that cash back you can get on those groceries. NerdWallet helps everyone make smarter financial decisions today, so the future you will thank you for it. With NerdWallet, you won't regret missing out on rewards. NerdWallet lets you compare smart cashback credit cards side by side to make the most of your everyday spending. So what could future you do with more cashback? A getaway with the kids? A spa day for yourself? Whatever it is, make it happen with a smarter cashback credit card. And don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Ask Lisa, a podcast to help people understand the psychology of parenting now in the midst of a pandemic. Psychologist Dr. Lisa DeMore, author of two New York Times best-selling parenting books, takes your questions. And I'm co-host Rena Ninen, a journalist and mom of two. Some of what we talk about comes from raising children ourselves. Most of the time, I'll be getting answers to your parenting questions. So send your questions to AskLisa at drlisademore.com. In this episode, we're going to cover dealing with conflict. So, Lisa, I noticed back in March in Wuhan, as they opened up, divorce rates skyrocketed.
I saw that too.
Did you see that? Like, people coming out of COVID suddenly realized they didn't like their spouse as much as they did at the beginning of this.
They like them better when they go places.
It is hard though, right? We're not meant to spend this much time alone together with our children or our partners.
No, I mean, it really is one of those things. Like, we all want more family time, but this is a lot of family time. There is no question about it. No question about it.
So how do you deal with this? Because, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are even co-parenting, who might not even be living in the same house, but are forced to interact more closely than ever before. And then you've got relationships of people who have been together a long time, not doing so well in the start of COVID, and have just deteriorated. What's your advice for dealing with people who are trying to cope with their children, whether they're young adults or elementary age kids, and partners, spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends? People realize a lot about the other person in the midst of quarantine.
All right, so let's think of this in two categories. One is where the conditions of living in a pandemic become fault finders, right? Where you know, if there was a crack, the pressure on that crack really causes it to, you know, open wide open. So maybe a relationship that was not in such good shape before, either between adults or between parents and children, the strain of living through this pandemic is definitely making whatever wasn't working well before now work really not well. So there's that. And then let's come back to this question of, like, relationships that were perfectly fine, but were just annoyed with everybody all the time, or they're around all the time and making themselves annoying, or we get annoyed. Right. So my experience of COVID-19 is that it just accelerates things. It just exacerbates things. And maybe it accelerates some positive changes. I'm sure it will. But I'm not surprised that we're seeing divorce rates go up in some countries. You know, we've got China leading the pack in terms of just being out ahead of everybody in the timeline on this, because stress is cumulative. And If you were under stress before COVID-19 or your relationship was under stress before COVID-19, then the strain of COVID-19 just lands on top of that and worsens it. And it may bring people to places they didn't think they'd get to in a relationship. I'm not convinced this is the worst thing ever, right? I'm not convinced that being forced to make a change that maybe one had been able to avoid or get around is a terrible thing. I know it's painful. I'm sure it's awful in many cases, but it also may be one of those things where people make changes and address problems that they had been effectively, you know, kind of brushing under the rug in the past.
How do you know when your relationship is just unable to be repaired, whether it's with a child or it's with a partner?
I think you can repair any relationship with a child. So let's assume there's always good work to be done in that department. Now, between adults, there may come a breaking point. And one of the things I learned along the way in my training is you know you're at a stopping place when you can no longer negotiate the terms of the relationship.
What do you mean?
So what I mean is if I were to say to my partner, a theoretical partner, listen, I feel like we're not spending the kind of time together I want, or I feel like you're not treating me in the way I want to be treated, or I feel like you're not hearing me when I say this. And it becomes clear that we've arrived at an impasse where that person has no interest in trying to meet me halfway or negotiate or take seriously my concerns. That's usually where things can come to grief. And they come to grief in one of two ways, which is that me, again, in this theoretical role, I might say, well, okay, so I accept that I'm not going to get everything I want out of this relationship, and I've tried, and I will take what I can get, and I will give up on what I'm asking for. Or it may come to grief of me saying, you know, what I've put on the table here is non-negotiable. You're not willing to come to the negotiating table. I'm ready to move on.
And then what about relationships where it's just COVID?
So, okay. So then there's just like garden variety, too much family time problems. So one thing that I think a lot of people are starting to discover is that we don't have to be together all the time. You know, I think in the early days, we're like, okay, this is terrifying and we're home together and like, let's have theme nights and let's have family game nights and let's have movie nights. And that was adorable and cute. And I think the cuteness has worn off and the need to be together constantly has worn off. What I am loving hearing about are ways in which people have found time apart in a way that doesn't feel like a rejection. So one parent told me about what they call yo-yo dinners, which is you're on your own dinner.
I mean, how often can a mom do that when parents do that?
How often must we eat together, I think, is the question here. And so one parent or another or a kid would be like, tonight's a yo-yo dinner night, which is basically feed yourself, you know. And I think that's brilliant. And I have called that several times since learning it. I have a daughter who's 16 who is an incredible diplomat. And I would say a couple months ago, out of nowhere, she said, you know, I think this weekend maybe we should take a sabbatical from one another.
I love it.
It was so cute. I love it. And you know, I negotiated some terms with her because I was like, well, can I hang out with Daddy? And she's like, yeah, you can do whatever you want, but I will be on sabbatical over in my room and I'll see you guys on Sunday. And I love that kind of positioning of it's not that I don't love you guys, it's that we do not need to be together all the time. So I think that that's a place to start in terms of reducing friction is to recognize we are not nearly accustomed to being together so much.
When you look at the relationship of being under quarantine, I mean, you and I talk about this all the time. It's wonderful to be able to work from home in a way that I would be on the 7:55 a.m. train to New York every day. But at the same time, you know, finding the separation from your children who you love and are not meant to be around 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for parents who are also struggling with their own identity of working, of trying to maintain a sense of normalcy, but not letting their kids feel that they don't want to be around them?
Yeah. I was talking to one of my clinical colleagues the other day, and she said a brilliant thing. She said, you know, we're moving from coping to adaptation. And I think she's really right. Like that just has been, you know, kind of knocking around in my head for a few days since she said it. And I think it's really useful to frame things in that way because we are now really having to adapt to the idea of being in our homes a lot for work and school, both extraordinarily strange conditions. And so it means we probably have to articulate things that we have yet to articulate. And so what I mean is I'm getting ready to, you know, get us into a school schedule where I am home all the time. And I think my daughters will be home all the time. That's what their school district is saying. And to start to articulate, okay, from 8:15 to 11:30, go to school. Mm-hmm. I'll see you for lunch at 11:30, then go back to school. And I'm using, you know, school in a loose term here, remote, yeah, hybrid, who knows what it'll look like. And then I'll see you again at 4. But to actually lay out the expected times of when we're going to be able to chat in the mm-hmm. middle of the day mm-hmm. and when we're each supposed to be doing our activities, despite the fact that we will occasionally run into each other when we stop to use the restroom or run down in the kitchen to get a snack.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on the Ask Lisa podcast. Stitch Fix sends style so good, you can feel it. They deliver all the confidence that comes from a truly amazing outfit without any of the work. You don't have to get into your car. You don't have to go through hangers and figure out what section to find what you're looking for. It's so simple. What my stylist does is they take my wardrobe to the next level. She shows me what works for me. She helps me discover new things that I like that I wouldn't have picked up if I was browsing online or even walking through a store. As the seasons change, you want different things. And when there are big events in your life that you want to dress up for, Stitch Fix has you covered. And I also love that I've got everyday staples from Stitch Fix that feel good on, that I am constantly reaching for in my wardrobe. Style that makes you feel as good as you look. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/AskLisa. That's stitchfix.com/AskLisa. stitchfix.com/AskLisa. Paying for college shouldn't be the hardest part of higher education. Hi, it's Rena Ninen, co-host of the Ask Lisa podcast. I recently spoke with U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona about FAFSA, the free application for student aid. Did you know you can apply for financial aid today, and you'll get a response within 1 to 3 days? Check out our show notes to the link for the full interview on our Ask Lisa podcast YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe for the latest videos from Lisa and me. That's the Ask Lisa podcast YouTube channel. Welcome back to the Ask Lisa podcast. So should there be rules of engagement with the family? And I'm thinking particularly now with school starting and trying to figure out a sense of normalcy to be productive at work, or if you're looking for work, to be able to have that time to look for a job. How do you show your children that you care, that you're engaged? They're likely doing school from home. Do you set up guidelines ahead of time? I mean, and with your partner or spouse, or, you know, if you're co-parenting with somebody else, like what would be your roadmap this fall for dealing with conflict, whether it's with a partner or with the child?
So in terms of engagement, I think the more we can be clear about what the expectations are, who's where doing what, if we're all going to be in the house together doing our thing, you know, I think that's a good place to start. Even within that, there's going to be friction. People are going to do things that are bothersome. They're going to interrupt, you know, us. We're going to get interrupted. We're going to interrupt our kids. And this is tedious, right? The pandemic at best can be described as tedious. We're all worn thin. I find my own patience can be very, very short and in very short supply. So then the question becomes when we crash into each other. Not if. When we crash into each other, how are we going to handle it? And I love talking about conflict because I think it's one of those incredibly human things that we don't take seriously enough in terms of how to do it badly and how to do it well. And this is something I wrote about a lot in Under Pressure, my most recent book, Because especially as we think about girls at school and girls in their peer groups, you know, they can get into some pretty nasty stuff and we can fault them for that. But I feel like, well, we didn't teach them how to do conflict well, so why are we shocked when they do conflict so badly?
Right.
So what I articulate there and that I find very helpful is to think about three metaphors that for me describe unhealthy conflict, like the kinds of conflict we can easily slip into that are not very good for us. So, or not very good for other people too. So the first is to be a bulldozer, meaning you just like run people over. So maybe I'm working and I get interrupted and I just get angry, you know, just get icky about it. The second is to be a doormat, which is where you let yourself be run over. So maybe I'm working, I've made it clear I can't be interrupted right now. And then I get interrupted and then I just kind of, oh, poor me, like kind of, you know, it's like just feel frustrated on my own, but don't do anything to resolve it. The third, and this is the most common, I think, generally, and also where I begin, which is to be a doormat with spikes, which is basically passive-aggressive behavior. I'm not proud, but I have a very powerful passive-aggressive streak. You can actually articulate even subdivisions of doormat with spikes. So there's using guilt as a weapon, there's, you know, playing the part of the victim, and there's involving third parties, you know, in a dispute that's really between two people. So it might be that, you know, I get interrupted and I'm like, oh, what are you doing? How can you do this to me, right? Or something like that. Do you start at one of these? Do you have if you're caught on a bad day, where would you go?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like I identify with all of them. Is that a bad thing?
Every single one.
It depends on the day. But, you know, it's interesting how you talk about these different methods of metaphors of dealing with conflict, because you were talking about, you know, how do you do conflict well? What's the key to doing conflict well? Like, we all know there's going to be conflict in our lives, right? So how do you master that before you even get into it?
So the key here is to try to not do those three things. And part of, I think, how you don't do them is you name them and you acknowledge them and you figure out where your first impulse is. So you try to catch it before you act on it. Mm-hmm. And the metaphor that I like for healthy conflict is to be a pillar, where you stand up for yourself while being respectful of the other person. It's hard to do it, and yet I think, you know, when we're doing a good job of conflict, we can get there. So maybe a kid interrupts us and we say, hey, look, you and I both know that we set out a schedule to prevent this. I'm going to ask you to respect that schedule, and I'm going to respect it with regard to you. You know, so something like that, where we both are direct and kind, but also clear about what needs to happen to keep this particular conflict from occurring repeatedly.
When you go into a conflict like this, you know, you talk about be a pillar, standing up tall for yourself. I think a lot of times the other person then feels like they haven't been heard, right?
Yeah, no, it can be, you get to some conflicts where you do feel stuck, right? That even if in articulating your own position, you feel like, look, this is fair, I'm being clear, you know, what I'm saying makes sense. And the conflict that I have watched unfold this summer that has been so painful to hear about in my practice and in my community is this one between parents and teenagers around teenagers wanting to see their friends because of course they want to see their friends. Yeah. They're teenagers. This is what they do. This is their oxygen. And parents being rightly reluctant to let that happen. I have to say, in my 25 years of caring for kids and families, this is the worst situation I have ever seen families put in of, you know, a teenager's absolutely understandable right and wish, well, I guess wish to go out with their friends in the most benign ways, right? And a parent's understandable concern that that in and of itself is dangerous. Even the most, you know, kind of mild activity now feels dangerous. And it's been excruciating to watch families try to work through this conflict because it is unlike any other I have seen in terms of both parties being 100% right and in disagreement with one another.
Right.
So on that one, I've fallen back on something, some research that I looked at a long time ago that I thought was so smart about how to get out of an impasse in a conflict. And it's where we ask each party to articulate the other party's position. So if a teenager is saying, come on, like, just let me go over to Billy's house, like, come on. And the parent is saying, no, you cannot go, right? And you can just see how this could get so ugly. As corny as it is, a really helpful next step is for the parent to say to the teenager, articulate, say in your own words why I am scared for you to go to Billy's. And for the teenager to say, to have to think through and say what the parent's position is on this. And ideally, you know, the teenager would be able to say, okay, well, you're scared I'm going over to Billy's because you have no idea who will be over there, really. I am telling you I intend to social distance, but you're worried that I'm not really going to social distance, or I'm going to get there and it's just going to be lots of kids who I'm psyched to see and we're going to all flop over each other like teenagers do. And, you know, that the teenager could lay it all out. And what, when it works best, the parent says, yep, all that. And there's also this other issue about your grandma. So say that too. And the teenager would say, okay, and you're worried about the fact that grandma is, you know, we see her and you're worried about her safety. So really making the adolescent say the parent's position and then trading, having the parent fully articulate the teenager's position. And really having the parent make themselves say, or not make themselves say, but like as a gesture and an important gesture, say, okay, so I'm my teenager, here's my concern. Everyone's over at Billy's, all of the activity is there, friendships are being made, romances are, you know, blooming. There's all sorts of cool stuff going on there. I'm totally missing out. I'm going to be completely out of the mix socially and cut out socially and unaware of what's going on socially. That feels awful. And then even say to the teenager, did I miss something? You know, and see what they say. Now, this doesn't obviously solve it, but it loosens it. It gives it some oxygen for the teenager and parent to try to figure out some kind of solution to more than anything, move out of the posture of being at odds with each other and move into a posture of, okay, we have this shared problem of COVID-19 and we have to figure out some reasonable path that lets both of our concerns be addressed.
Do you find that teenagers are willing to do this? Because essentially what I hear is it's teaching the other side, both parents and the teens, a sense of empathy, of feeling what the other person is going through in this moment.
That's exactly right. And it's corny as all get out. So if you ask a teenager to do it, you have to say that. Say, look, I know this is dumb, but I want you to do this for me and I'll go first. Teenagers, I think, will often do it, especially if the teenager hears the parent go first and go in full earnestness, you know, really try to name the teenager's experience. And there is something so mind-shifting about having to say the words yourself about what the other person is thinking and feeling and to try to get accuracy there. And it does. It cultivates tremendous empathy to have those words come out of your own mouth. Mm. And that's true both for the parent and teenager.
You know, this reminds me of high school. I took this. I think everybody in the country should be required to take it. It was a law enforcement class taught by Mrs. Jackson at King High School. And she did a mediation class. And what she taught us was when you're trying to articulate another side, your side to someone, you say, when you do X, it makes me feel X. And in the future, I would really like it if you X. Mm-hmm. And I think being in high school, it taught a lot of students how to articulate where you're coming from in a way that isn't explosive or reactive. And sometimes that's hard when you're impassioned and you're feeling these emotions and trying to get it across to someone who really is not in a space to hear where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, I mean, what Mrs. Jackson gave you was basically a pillar formula. But you're right. I mean, part of the problem is these interactions are hot. And it's very hard in that heat to be sometimes the parents we want to be. And, you know, certainly kids and teenagers are not at their best when they're angry or upset or don't feel heard. But what I think what we could get with this is to really be accepting that there will absolutely be conflict. That if humans are together at all, especially together like we're together now, there's going to be conflict. And then you can do it better or worse, right? You can do it, you know, as a bulldozer or doormat with spikes, or you can do it all hot, or you can do it without considering the other person's perspective, or you can pillar your way, you can try to take the other person's perspective, you can try to cool off a little bit before engaging fully. But the conflict's a done deal. And to even accept that advances where we are so much further than most people start, because a lot of people feel like, oh no, we've got a conflict, we shouldn't have a conflict. All right, conflicts, they are happening. Yo-yo dinners give you a break sometimes, but I'm always cautious of anything that sounds sort of silver lining-ish about the pandemic. But we're gonna have a lot of practice at conflict and living with each other in close quarters. We could get better at this. There's no question we can get better at this.
I think some of the things you've told me over the summer was this right now. Expect conflict. I think that's pretty big. But also saying that being sad or depressed, that you should acknowledge it, that we're in this pandemic, and that's not a crazy emotion or an emotion that you should just, you know, let go lightly. Like acknowledging that you feel that way is also something.
Yeah. No, if we hit a big cosmic reset button on how people feel about negative emotions, I'd actually be okay with that. We have spent, I mean, since 1980, since Prozac came on the scene, we have decided as a culture that we don't like negative emotions. That was never helpful. They are part of life. Conflict's part of life. It all needs to be managed. It can be managed better. It can be managed worse. But maybe we could stand down a little bit from trying to not have conflicts and trying to feel good all the time. It's both, in some ways, a tough pill to swallow. It's also a huge relief if you can say to yourself, you know what, I'm going to get annoyed with people. We're not always going to get along. We'll try to handle it well. I'm going to feel crummy sometimes. Mostly I'll be able to handle it well. I don't need to be scared of feeling upset.
I think we're so eager to chase happiness and feeling good all the time that we don't know sometimes that it's okay to feel down and let that in.
And if you're not feeling down in a pandemic. And I guess another way to sort of put a happier note on it is you can still have fun in a pandemic. And I think as we move from coping to adaptation, we're discovering that too.
So Lisa, what would you say your top parenting to go tip would be for today?
All right, parenting to go. Thinking about conflict, to stick with our theme. One thing I know is true with kids and teenagers is sometimes when they're upset, they say stuff that the second it is out of their mouth, they wish they hadn't said it. This happens with grown-ups too. You know, they're impulsive, stuff gets out in front of them, their mouths get out in front of them, and it's super inappropriate, and the parent knows it and the kid knows it instantly. A gracious and also tactical maneuver as a parent in that moment is to say, I'm going to pretend I did not hear that. And it both draws the line that is very reassuring and totally expected by the kid, and lets the kid restart and do over, and spares the parent having to go after the kid for what they did or said. It just lets them hit a reset button.
We want to thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in each week as we dig into your latest parenting questions. You can send those questions straight to us at asklisa@drlisademore.com. Now a word from our lawyers. The advice provided on this podcast does not constitute or serve as a substitute for professional psychological treatment, therapy, or other types of professional advice or intervention. If you have concerns about your child's well-being, consult a physician. or a medical health professional. If you're looking for additional resources or information about this podcast, check out Lisa's website, drlisademoore.com. We'll see you next week.